On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we take you behind the scenes at Interop Las Vegas 2013. We talk about DDoSing our own network. Avaya's got a brand new fabric. And Chibert is dusty, dry, and windy. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 40, recorded May 6, 2013. Viva Las Interop. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by Ting.com. Ting is a new mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay for what you use, doesn't require a contract, and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit enterprise.ting.com. That's enterprise.ting.com. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And I'm on location live at Interop Las Vegas 2013 at the Mandalay Bay Convention Center. And let me tell you, we've got an action-packed, character-packed show, starting with, of course, my good friend, Mr. Brian Chi, the evangelist from Thin Links. Brian, how do you find Las Vegas?
It's very dry, it's very windy, and it's very dusty, but I'm looking forward to all kinds of playing some slot machines, and I saw Sir Elton last night doing an amazing concert called The Million Dollar Piano.
And I think we just found the episode title, Dry, Windy, and Dusty. Of course, we're not all dry, windy, and dusty. We've got Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, you made the trek all the way from Florida. Thank you very much for joining us in Las Vegas.
Yeah, happy to be here in the desert, waiting for all my skin to fall off after coming here from the swamp. But while I'm waiting for that to happen, we've got some great coverage coming up for Enterprise Efficiency. It's always a pleasure to be here. There are buffets out there, the depths of which I have not yet plumbed. So always something to do.
Yes. And of course, I have a lot of experience with buffets, having eaten all of them. Not at all of them, but eaten all of them. Our last panelist is actually, he's our first of three guests, Mr. Ken Bacchino from F5. Ken, we had you on a special video not too long ago, just last week. And in fact, your colleague the week before that, talking about DDoS. Are you going to share more of that wealth?
Hi, yes. Welcome to be here. Today, we're going to demonstrate some of the DDoS capabilities and protection capabilities of the Interop network. So stand by for that a little bit later.
Absolutely. So you stay tuned because we've got our DDoS special coming up just after this. First, I would like to show you a little video that explains how we come into the convention center, how we find the space, and how we start to set up Interop. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, host of Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech on the Twit Network. We're here at the Mandalay Bay Convention Center for Interop Las Vegas 2013. Just this morning, this was nothing but bare concrete. That's right, they had cleaned the show floor from the previous show, and then we brought in trucks, we brought in forklifts, we brought in all these crates so that this bare floor could be turned into a miniature city. I'm going to give you a behind-the-scenes look at what it takes to put on the world's most advanced temporary network. There are a few things that I want to point out on this day one. The first is that we've had an army of volunteers in the NOC here on the show floor, running cable, running fiber, testing all the drops, making sure that we actually have a network that we can deliver to our customers. The second thing is that we are essentially a miniature ISP. We've got these bundles of copper that are in the ceiling, dropping down to each booth to give each vendor a gigabit of internet access. We've also got these spools of fiber that go from rack to rack, or as we call them, from ped to ped, which give us the long-haul capabilities that we need and, well, a 10-gig ring. No small feat. The other thing to recognize is that the engineers here aren't just delivering a network. We don't just want to give our customers what they paid for. They're here because they really believe in interoperability. We're all working in this NOC, all these engineers from different companies, because we want our products to work together. That's the spirit of the original interop. Now, I am going to show you some really, really cool features over the next couple of days. I'm going to show you how our engineers are DDoSing our own network in order to make sure we have something that we can deliver. I'm going to show you the education that our volunteers will be undergoing because we want to train them as much as we need their help. I'm going to show you how the enterprise has come to include things like, well, Apple in the enterprise and BYOD. In fact, I'm going to show you all the latest and all the greatest, along with the loving embrace of our lead engineer, Glenn Evans. So stay tapped, because I'm going to bring you the best gear. I'm going to bring you the best practices. I'm going to bring you the uber geeky coolest parts of Interop 2013. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire. Just keep quiet. Of course, we did promise that we're going to be talking about DDoSing our own network, and that's why we brought in Ken Bocchino, F5 engineer extraordinaire. Ken, tell us, okay, why would you want to DDoS your own network? Let's just start with that, because it does sound a little weird to attack something that we just set up.
So the main reason why you want to actually DDoS your own self is to actually prepare for an attack that you potentially will have in the future. So it does make a lot of sense to go through the due diligence to go through and figure out what type of vulnerabilities you're vulnerable to and how to go then and protect against that. So when an attack does come to your enterprise network, you're prepared and ready for it.
Okay. Now, we've got a huge external connection here. We've got 100 gigabit. I can understand when we were DDoSing ourselves, when we had like a 15 megabit or a 10 megabit, or even, you know, when you've got a small network with like a 2 megabit network, because you can fill the pipe really, really quickly. But with 100 gigabit, how do you do that? What, do you set up a bunch of laptops? Do you have a specialized piece of gear? How do you generate that much traffic that quickly?
So the way we're actually generating traffic for the show to attack it is actually using breaking point gear. So it essentially is a test tool set that enterprises can use to simulate the actual attacks that they're going to see out in the wild. So anonymous attacks, as well as just basic SQL injection types of attacks that are constantly happening across the internet. So this is a great tool set to allow you to do multi-gig attacks against your own infrastructure to validate that it's functioning properly, both as an attack and client perspective. So you can actually just test single pieces of gear within your infrastructure without impacting your production environment.
Curtis, I want to get your opinion on this, representing the enterprise efficiency side of the equation. Do executives understand what a DDoS is? I mean, we ran a little bit of a primer. Do they understand the different ways that their networks can get attacked and their services can be brought down? Or do they just sort of group it together as, oh, those are hackers?
I think that executives understand in broad strokes what a DDoS attack is. They understand that there are things that can happen that make the network unavailable because people are flooding it with traffic. Once you get below that, once you try to put any finer grain on it, I think they both lose the ability to follow it and lose interest very quickly. You know, it's very binary for most executives. Either the network and its services are available or they aren't. And if they aren't, they want to know what you're going to do and how quickly you can solve the problem.
Chibert, let me throw this over to you. It's become a larger problem recently because fast connections are very easy to come by. And not only that, we've got off-the-shelf tools, something like low-orbit ion cannon and Tor, which allows me as a hacker, a black hat hacker, to launch a lot of traffic at any given destination for almost no money with almost no specialized gear of my own. It used to be if I wanted to launch a sophisticated attack, I would actually have to invest in things like an infrastructure and equipment. Now, anyone with a credit card or a PayPal account can launch 100 gigabits of traffic at my network. How has the landscape changed over the last 10 years?
Well, a lot of things have changed. Is a lot of hackers are going in for social engineering. They're trying to get that malware onto the machine so we can distribute it out. maybe the pipes are getting bigger, but there's an awful lot of people that have infected machines out there. And we're seeing, that's why it's distributed. We've got a lot of people coming from a lot of different places. And that aggregate really gets massive. And that's the reason why universities are such big targets. Universities typically have really big pipes and a lot of people that don't always patch their machines.
Yeah, it's a lot easier when you've got a lot of machines that are just vulnerable. Okay, let me go back to you. So we talked a little bit about the DDoS attack and its ramifications and how it's developed. Show me what we're doing here at Interop.
Sure. So just quickly, I have a screenshot up on my screen here, just showing you the overall layout of the infrastructure. It's got a little bit bigger here. So essentially what this is the front edge infrastructure that we are providing high availability for, as well as that DDoS protection. So you can see in the green boxes on the left, there are those breaking points I was speaking to earlier. Those are the generation points for essentially spoofing the address space of the internet coming inbound towards the front edge. And the front edge there are those two large Vibrion F5 devices capable of dealing with that type of immense load. The 100 gig links are allowing us, you know, that pipe up into our Denver facility, which is where that breaking point sits and where we're emulating the internet attacks.
Right. Now, you mentioned last week that there's really two strategies you can do here. The first is to have a box that can just respond to a lot of packets at the same time. It has to be powerful. It has to be able to actually address each and every single packet and decide attack, not attack, legit, not legit. The other strategy was push everything to the edge. You know, get it out to the point where I'm not allowing any of that attack traffic to actually affect services. So to the outside, to the inside user, he or she shouldn't even know that the network is being attacked, right?
And you have to actually use a variety of different strategies in regards to protecting yourself. As a large enterprise that might not have more than 10 gigs of connectivity, you're going to have to come up with a strategy of both cloud solutions as well as in-house solutions, because the attack vectors are going to change. Nowadays, attack groups are actually building campaigns out to attack a site instead of just simply going after and using a command and control server, a single command and control server using one type of attack. They're getting much more complex in regards to the attack vectors being used, and we're seeing a myriad of different types of attacks that are a little bit more difficult to defend against if you only have one type of protection mechanism. So you're going to use a strategy of both cloud solution to deal with the pipe filling types of attacks that are common to close down whatever pipe you have to your enterprise. And then once you filter that type of attack out, you're going to start looking at application-based signatures that you can build around the more advanced attacks into the application front end and middleware chairs that are quite vulnerable to crafted attacks.
Okay, now let's get down to brass tacks. This is the moment of truth. We promised we would do this. We're actually going to attack our own network with 100 gigabits of traffic while we're streaming this. So I have no idea what's going to happen. We tested this on Friday, and it seemed to work. But if Jason, if you could split screen between the screen sharing and the wide view camera, you're going to tell us first, what kind of switches are you going to flip? What should we see on the screen?
Sure. So again, as I said earlier, we're using the XDR Breaking Point platform to actually start these attacks. So what I'm going to do right now is actually start off a UDP flood attack down our 100 gig pipe.
Okay.
And
okay.
So we're kicking it off right now. So it's loading up. I'm going to actually, just because we have two of these, I'm going to kick.
You're going to tell me before you actually click the button, right?
It's already clicked.
It's clicked. Oh,
so,
okay.
So we're kicking off 14 gigabits of second down our 100 gig pipe. And on our box, our Ixia box here, we're actually pushing 20 gigabits to the front edge. So the stream that you're seeing right now is actually going over a pipe that has roughly 30, 40, 50 gigabits per second of traffic flow. And actually, we have some cool tools here at the InteropNet that is going to let us see what that looks like. So on my screen right now is actually a product from CPacket. This is showing, and it's going to refresh here in a few minutes, this is showing the actual load coming in through that front 100 gig pipe. We can actually see that also on our F5 dashboard. We can see that we're seeing about 55.9 gigabits of inbound UDP floods. And essentially what the F5 is doing right now is blocking that traffic based on the pattern matching that we've configured on the device. So we're seeing the pattern and we're dropping it. We're not actually putting it back towards the user. So essentially this attack is attacking all the different users at the Interop show, including the laptops we're sitting in front of.
Wow, so this is amazing because right now we're getting all this traffic flooding our network and the stream is still running.
I'm just kidding. No, seriously. No, it's still working. Okay, so tell me, what's going on inside the box? So it's actually looking for patterns, right? It's looking for attack versus legit traffic, and then it's sorting those out. But it's doing it at a speed at which we can maintain high definition. We've got four high-definition streams coming out of this content corner right now, and I'm pretty sure no one's even seen a glitch.
Yeah, so what you're actually seeing is the performance and capability of the F5 platform. The Traffic Management OS, the TMOS, has been tuned over the last 13 years since our company started to be able to process this type of load within the platform. Okay. We're doing it very quickly at the lower levels of the hardware platform to be able to quickly drop that traffic or allow that traffic based on the rule sets that we have.
All right, so I have to ask, at what point does the box become overwhelmed? And so we got 100 gigabits of traffic. We know that your box can handle that with barely breaking a sweat. Theoretically, how much traffic could one of your Viperion boxes handle before it starts crying uncle?
So the box we have in place right now can actually do 320 gigabits per second of load. And millions, 130 some odd millions, don't quote me on that, connections per second coming into the device. And then we have a bigger model that can actually do double that. Okay. The Viperion 4800 platform.
Now, one of the interesting things is it's not just the hardware. I mean, the hardware is very cool. The fact that it could do this is absolutely fantastic. But it's also the way you set it up, because you can install a Viperion in the wrong way, at the wrong point in your network, and suddenly you're getting none of the benefits.
Correct. So what we actually want to do is actually put this out at the edge. We want to be the first device that is dealing with the traffic flow. So as data center hosting evolves, we're seeing that the enterprise-based firewall can't really handle the loads of these types of attacks. So putting the F5 appliance closer and closer to the front edge of your enterprise is going to allow us to deal with that connection load and handle it quite quickly, and also be flexible enough to build those signatures to detect those attacks as they change throughout an overall campaign of the attackers that are coming after you. Attackers in campaigns can change over a period of 20, 30 minutes as those groups decide or detect that those attacks they have designed aren't working anymore. And with low orbit ion cannon, the booster packs are quite easy to go out and get. So we're seeing that companies that are being made aware that they're going to be attacked are able to go after the binaries and the information that the attackers are sending out to the different groups that are going to run those attacks. And you can actually build those signature sets quite rapidly on the appliances and install them so that you're now protecting against the attack that just told all the activists to run. So you can actually play that cat and mouse game as the attack continues to stop those types of attacks.
Ken, thank you very much for coming on to talk to us. We talk to you every year because, well, I mean, you're protecting our network. Quick plug, what do you want to talk about? Where should people go to find out more about your products or any projects you may be working on?
Sure. Go off to F5.com. If you're at the show, come visit us in the NOC. Come visit us at the F5 booth. And more information about the actual F5 deployment at Interop can be found at f5.enet.interop.net.
That's great. Thank you. Wonderful that you're dropping that knowledge on the Twiat crowd. Now, I do want to take a moment here to talk about the first of our sponsors, because you know what? They've been with us since the beginning of this program, and I think they need some serious love from the Twiat Riot. Now, when Leo built the Brick House, he decided that he wanted us to eat our own dog food. We were a network all about forward thinking, looking forward into the future of tech to do the things that we're asking our listeners and our viewers to do. That includes doing everything in the cloud. And we do everything in the cloud at the Brick House. We do all of our docs on Google Docs. We do our email in the cloud. Pretty much every service that we can push away from our own infrastructure, we do it because we believe in it. So when Russell, the IT guy, went over to Leo and told him, hey, you know what? You can have a PBX system without an actual PBX in the building. Well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. There's zero startup costs. There's no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling. Our producers love getting their voicemail in their emails, and we can even get all of our fax messages right on our smartphones. And now they have a brand spanking new feature, Business SMS. That's right, you can now send text messages to your customers and colleagues from your business phone number. There's no more using your personal number to do business. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to visit RingCentral. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. One more time, because it's so noisy in this convention center, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, coming up in just a minute, we're going to be talking all about the interop culture and how you survive a conference as big and as crazy as, well, the largest temporary network, the most advanced temporary network in the world. But before that, I want to give you a little bit of a sneak peek behind the scenes of Interop 2013.
I'm Father Robert Balasair, the Digital Jesuit, host of TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech on the TWiT Network. And I'm here on a stroll, a little drive through the end of Interop setup, day two. We're pretty much alone at the Mandalay Bay Convention Center. Most of the contractors have gone home. And as you can see, the show floor is in, well, different states of array. Some of the larger booths, some of the larger vendors have set up a large chunk of their displays, whereas there are still a few vendors, smaller typically, that are still in their boxes. But big or small, the thing that binds them all together is the fact that they're connected to our network. Again, one of the unique things about the InteropNet is that we build it. We are the ones who drive every single packet that runs to and from the show floor. You can't say that about most conferences. Now, one of the things that allows us to do that is this. This innocuous piece of gear is actually an MPEO cartridge. I mentioned green yesterday, these spools of fiber that you can see up on my left. Well, what we do is we build this network in California, we tear it apart, and then we put it back together. If we had to do each and every single fiber run, and in the past we've had to, that would take forever. Not only would it take forever, but it just introduces a lot of chance for, error. Dirty fiber or a mispatched piece of fiber. This allows us to take one single bayonet connector, input it, and get six fiber connections out. Again, the cool thing about this is it allows us to get quick setup with just a few connections. Now, this green hose is unique because it allows us to have 24 pairs of fiber. I mentioned this yesterday in the vlog. That's 12 pairs of multimode, which is what most of you would typically run if you've got a data center. Then there's 6 pairs of optimized multimode, which will support up to 10 gig. And finally, 6 pairs of single mode for those really long distance runs. This is one of the systems that, you know, we call green. It's actually System X that saves us each and every time we put together Interop. Now, that's not the only cool thing. Something else that's cool for this year's Interop is this. This device is actually a MikroTik router board. It's a cool device in and of itself, but we're not really using it for its design purpose. That's right, here at Interop, we like to hack things up, and that's definitely what we've done with this MikroTik. We're using these as customer experience measuring tools. Now, we've got all sorts of network tools in the NOC. We can tell you if a server is running properly. We can tell you if the environment is wrong for one of the racks. We can tell you if we're using too much power, how our bandwidth is holding up. We can tell you if there's a customer who has a misconfigured switch in his booth. We can tell you if we're being DDoSed. But one of the things that's always very difficult to tell is how that network management is translating into actual experience. You can see in front of me, we've got a couple of our ITMs. These are our Interop team members who are patching things together. They're actually allowing us to, connect all of our customers. But sometimes, you know, if they get out of my way as I drive through here, we want to know how the customer's doing, not how the network's doing. That's right. They're going to say hi to me. That's where the MikroTik comes into play. We've deployed these all over the show floor, all around off show floor in the classrooms, because they're relatively inexpensive. And, you're probably going to see a few of these if you actually come to Interop. What they're allowing us to do is to come into them through the management interface and actually use them like a user. Ask them to load CNN. Ask them to check their email. Ask them to get a DHCP address. Simulate all the things that a regular user would do, and then find out how the network is responding responding to the user's request. It is just another data point, but it's a very interesting data point for us, because rather than just saying, well, yes, we've served out this many connections, we have this many concurrent wireless devices, we have this much bandwidth going through the network, we can actually say a user at this part of our network, in this part of the convention center, is going to be having this kind of experience. It's just one of the things that we love about Interop, because we're not just setting up a network, we're playing with things that are probably going to become, well, a standard part of the network of the future. Again, we're going to be showing you more and more stuff. I believe tomorrow I'm going to show you the core PEDs, the core rack, show you the equipment that's actually driving most of the bandwidth, most of the connections that are running Interop. And I'm also going to show you how we've been DDoSing the network straight for the past couple of days with no ill effects. I'm Father Robert. Stay tabbed. We've got more from Interop 2013.
Joining us now is Mr. Mark Sullivan. He's one of the team leads. I've actually known him for about 10 years. About the same time that I met Chibert, I met Mark. He's a brilliant engineer, and well, he kind of holds Interop together. Mark, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you very much, Robert.
Now, tell us, what is it that you do here?
Well, you know, I am, for this show, responsible for the physical lead, the infrastructure of the Interop Net for Las Vegas 2013.
Yeah, so basically, if it's connected to something else, it's your responsibility.
That's correct.
Okay, all right.
I hook it all together.
All right. Now, you're here to talk a little bit about the culture of Interop, surviving Interop, but I want to start off talking about those little boxes that I was holding up on that little tour, the MicroTICs. Now, exactly what are these designed to do? Because I don't think we're using them for their design purpose, right?
Correct. The MicroTIC is basically just a router board that can be used in any environment. What we've decided to do is start doing some... We monitor everything that we possibly can in this network, and we're really good at knowing when things are up or down. One of the things that we've tried to do this year is identify what is the actual end user experience out in the wild. And so what we're using this device for is to give us real-time feedback about the performance of the network from the end user's perspective. In other words, how long does it take for a DNS resolution to take place? How long is a DHCP transaction taking place? How long does it take to browse a website?
Right. Now, this is incredibly useful information for us, because most of our networking management tools, they tell us if, well, let's say a link is getting saturated. They'll tell us if a link starts flapping. They'll tell us if a piece of equipment has been removed. But there's a dearth of equipment out there that can actually say, hey, your network, it may look good, but a user in such and such classroom on such and such floor is having a horrible experience because he can't get a DHCP address.
That's absolutely correct. And what we're trying to do is, rather than try to kind of be, pedantic, if you will, about, the information that's out there, about up, down, as you just mentioned, we definitely want to know what is the user actually experiencing when they plug their laptop in or they jump on the Wi-Fi, how is their experiencing being? And if there's any kind of a problem within the environment, we can identify that, hopefully before the user starts, reporting that, and go and start to seek out what's the problem. When we see DNS resolution times increase above 100 milliseconds, we know there's a problem that we have to go sort out.
Chibert, I want to throw this over to you, because you've actually done some work with user experience type technologies. On a campus, you have to be concerned with how the users are actually using your services. You can't just put services up and say, well, it's green lights on my side. If a dean or a professor says, hey, I've got issues with throughput, you need some sort of metrics to be able to measure that. How useful would a device like, well, the thing that we're hacking be on your campus?
Actually, academics, I don't see it that often, just because most academic IT shops are so dramatically understaffed and underfunded that they actually play kind of the sand in the head type of game. Now, when you start getting into medicine, law, some of the high risk
career
segments,
yeah. Deployments,
then you really need to know what's going on. And when seconds or minutes make a huge, huge difference, let's use medicine as an example. If all of a sudden the network stops running nice and fast and you can't pull up a drug allergy, someone dies on the operating room table or in the emergency room. So things like that, that's where I start seeing a lot of user experience measurements. There's a lot of them out there, but the MicroTIC is one of those really, really interesting devices because it's designed for open source.
you can actually go and throw lots of really interesting things on it and make it do all kinds of strange and weird and wonderful things. Heck, we've even put BGP on it and parked subnets on MikroTik routers in between shows.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really love about this. When they first started playing around with these at HotStage, the fact that it's kind of like a Lego set for geeks. There's just, you could load anything on it and make it do anything you want. I think this is actually the future for deployments like this. Not really specialized hardware that costs, you know, $2,000-$3,000 a pop, but something like this, which costs, what was it, $80?
Yeah,
less than $80. Right. Get something like this, throw a bunch of them all over the place, and then get a lot of data points. Curtis, I want to ask you about this. Again, going from the enterprise efficiency side, a low-cost device that can tell us how users are actually using the resources that we've deployed, how useful would that be in an enterprise setting?
I think it's very useful, and especially now that we're starting to get into issues like cloud computing and the various service level agreements, which are often based on the metrics that come from a user perspective. When people are looking at things like how many seconds does it take to do anything from get a defined transaction finished to getting something as simple as a cursor back. When you can't see that from the user perspective, you can't measure it from the user perspective. If you can't measure it from the user perspective, then it becomes very difficult to enforce those service level agreements. And so while this was something that traditionally would have been useful for the IT department, I think cloud computing and offsite resources make it critical to the IT department. So for me, something like this is something we're going to see more and more IT departments using. There are some services out there that claim to do it. Of course, Keynote has built an entire business model on doing things from the end user perspective. This gives the IT department the ability to do it in-house, to really tailor it to their needs. And I think that's going to be something more and more IT departments are going to be interested in doing.
Nice. Mark, you know what? Let's step away from the useful stuff and let's talk about the fun stuff, because Interop is a weird place. Just the other day, you were explaining to me your thoughts on Interop being a tribal environment. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So Interop is really two things, as you know. We all think of it in terms of it's a network, and you bring all these engineers together. But Interop is, from a social standpoint, is kind of an organization that kind of governs itself with a certain set of rules and policies, and they're pretty much all not written down in any way, shape, or form. The knowledge that has been in Interop over the years, we started in the 80s, right, with a certain group of people. And it's tribal in nature from the standpoint that the information that is kind of passed from person to person over time. We do have certain rules of how we conduct ourselves. And anybody that's been in the Interop family or tribe, if you will, over the years, starts to learn those rules of conduct. I mean, they're very loose and they're not formalized or written down, but there's certain things that you do and you don't do within the environment. And there's a certain hierarchy within the Interop net. And, you know, this year, you know, kind of the lead of that, of course, is Glenn. And then you have all of the other actors within the environment. And then you have kind of, if you will, our volunteers that come and join us, especially the new ones, kind of start to get brought into that. And what you'll see over time, like in any tribe, some people will kind of come in and come out, and some people will kind of stay and remain glued together. And then some people will come in and be there for a while and then move out, and they become the elder statesmen, of the InteropNet tribe, if you will.
And one of the things that has always struck me is how much we do Interop even when we're not doing Interop. We have a list. We keep in touch. You know, it's amazing sometimes the questions that come across. We have a simple email list, and the amount of knowledge that exists at Interop that we can pull from is really dazzling. Cheebert, let me throw over to you. You've been doing this way longer than I have.
1995.
Yeah, since 1995. And you have this sense of the Interop net being a resource. Can you tell me about one time that you actually reached out to Interop and it really helped you to fix something?
Actually, I can tell a story about a friend. He had a piece of Fluke test equipment and it was giving a really strange error on it. And so he calls up a friend that just happens to be sitting in the next cubicle from the product manager. And he reads off this error. He goes, Is there a radio station next to you? And he turns around and there's a tower for a radio station right behind him. He goes, why don't you type this code in? We'll desensitize the instrument. And lo and behold, it worked just fine.
Right. The funny thing about it is interop to us is sort of like it's the internet before the internet. The collection of minds, the Rolodex that you had, that you could literally call up anyone at any given time and find someone who was an expert about anything. Now, Mark, I want to go back to you because there is something else about interop, and that is surviving interop. Oh, you pitched me this idea a while back. The things that you need as a lead engineer to survive what is essentially a month out of your life. Yep. You have 2 weeks of hot stage, 2 weeks of the show. Start me off. What's your first item?
Okay, so in order to survive interop, the first thing you have to have is a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Because we can go and talk about the tools and all of that, but what it's really what you need to survive is a sense of humor and the ability to come in and work, be willing to work with individuals. You'll have to be able to be very self-critical about yourself. And you have to be willing to, accept feedback because, let's be honest, we all have a few egos in this environment, don't we?
Yes. And, and Eric Flynn in the chat room says, don't start drinking on the first day. I would actually reverse that. I think you need to start drinking on the first day, right?
Yeah.
It helps.
It certainly does help. So, so that's kind of key for just general survival within the interop. There are some actual physical things that I'd like to share with you,
yes.
Audrey.
Yes, okay. All right.
So, first of which is red vines. We eat a lot of red vines.
We do not share this. We do not share this love. I mean, but yeah, we have at least 2 to 3 engineers on the team who they will not do anything unless we have a supply of red vines.
Absolutely.
I don't know what it is. It's the concentrated sugar. It's the ability to be chewing on one of these as you're patching stuff in. And I think it's also the fact that you can, even with hands that are dirty from forklift soot, they still taste decent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So red vines. Sure. All right. That's our start.
Okay. So here in Las Vegas, you need lots of this.
Thank you, Dwayne Knight.
Lots and lots of water. You have to drink quite a bit of this. I probably go through about 4 or 5 bottles of this a day. Even though we're in a relatively cool environment at the moment because they've shut the doors and turned on the air conditioner, it still gets extremely dry out here. So we have to make sure that we're drinking plenty of water. I won't discuss it, but we actually have a technique within the environment that we discuss at our kickoff meeting that tells you whether or not you're consuming enough water.
Let's just say it's a body hack. In fact, it's not even a hack. It's a way of being tuned to your body and the things that it may produce that will tell you if interop is sucking all the moisture out of your body.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, okay,
so this is probably the number one tool that you can survive at interop. We'll go through just about every other piece of equipment. We have screwdrivers and wrenches and everything else. I pick this up and use this probably 200 times a day when I'm at interop. Now, the one thing that I'm required not to do is to cut the fiber.
That's right.
That's the one don't do at interop. But I'll tell you what, other than that, when you're going to cut something out, you need to snip something quickly. Even if you just need to cut a piece of paper, these devices, $8. The funny thing is, you know what? I lose $1,000 tools. I've managed to hang on to my $8 snips for about 4 years.
I had a nice pair of snips. They now belong to the TSA. Okay, so continue. We've got snips, we've got red vines, we've got water.
Okay. Inevitably, you're going to be working around gear, trying to reach through the pads and the equipment. Band-Aids. Plain and simple. Bring lots of them. I can tell you from over the years, these hands, they just get trashed from doing this work. So,
Because we do like to injure people, by the way.
Absolutely. Okay, and then finally, I have aspirin. Lots and lots of aspirin.
That now, doesn't look like aspirin.
We were talking about, the first night. Yep, this helps the next morning.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Now, okay, so this, we're joking, of course. I mean, these are useful tips, but it's all because this is a collective knowledge that we've had over years of doing this. I remember, I think we started at the same time, right?
Just about.
At the Las Vegas Convention Center?
Yeah, exactly.
I think we started as ITMs, just patching cables, and slowly we kind of moved up in the hierarchy, and now we actually get to tell other people what to do. At least you do. I don't really get to do that anymore. But one of the things about interop has always been that behind us, that's why we include them in the shot. there are engineers here who actually wrote the white papers that have allowed us to create the internet. Chiba, let me throw this over to you. You figured out at some point the percentage of critical white papers written by interop team members, yes?
Around 60% now.
Oh, what is it again? I'm sorry?
About 60%. Yep. And including, I might say, our Norwegian contingent were partially responsible for IP over avian carrier.
explain that.
Carrier pigeon.
Yes. Okay. So we've got all sorts of networking here. Curtis, you have not been involved as an engineer at Interop, but you've probably covered more interops than I have. Tell me, what have you seen over the years as you look in that fishbowl that is the NOC?
You know, the biggest thing that I see, and the thing that impresses me more than anything else, are the knots of engineers that form, where you actually have people with differing levels of expertise and areas of expertise that get together and solve problems. You know, that's something that you like to think will happen on every job and on every team, but it doesn't. It's less common than you'd like to think. And to see it happen on a regular basis at Interop is incredible. The other thing that is important is watching that same level of interactivity happening with the students, the people who are beginning their careers, who are here learning from those who have been doing it for, well, times that are counted best in decades. That's, again, something that you'd like to think happens at every job site, on every team. But to see it happening as effectively and efficiently as it happens each year here at Interop is really something that gives me hope for the future of the industry.
All right, now I want to open this up. I didn't prepare anyone for this question before, but I'd like to, at least the engineers here, so the guys who have actually helped to set up Interop, talk about one embarrassing / interesting story from Interop. Chibert, I'm going to start with you because I know you've got a bunch of them. Pick one. Pick your favorite Interop story.
My favorite Interop story actually was when I had the flu, naturally. You know, you come to a big show like this, someone's got the flu, and of course, I caught it. And I was responsible for fiber that year, and I was told, okay, I can unpatch a certain portion of the network. So I went up to the patch panels, which happened to be three stories above the Las Vegas Convention Center, and started unpatching. I get back down after about 2-3 hours, and everybody's running around going crazy. The network's down, the network's down. I go, you told me to unpatch the patch panels. Yeah, not all of them. And so I brought down the network as we were tearing out the system.
I'll actually share a brought down the network story. I think I've shared this before, but I love it because it's me. It's very me. A while back, I was a network monitoring lead. So I was responsible for all the equipment and all the software that tested the health of the network. Well, we were setting up back at the warehouse in California, and the little klaxon and the little flasher kept going off because, of course, as you're setting up, there's always going to be things that are missing. So I disabled them temporarily. Problem is, I forgot to turn them back on. So we get on site and run the show. And at the end, if you've ever been to Interop, you know that there's a point at which we shut down the show floor, but we have to keep running the network because we've got classrooms running. So we're in the NOC. Everything's being torn down around us. And of course, it's noisy because we've got all the equipment. And then all of a sudden, you hear this, ooh, and that's all the fans and the hard drives all spinning down at the same time. And it gets deadly quiet. And we're looking around, and then everyone looks at me, and I realize that I had forgotten to turn the klaxon back on. And what had happened was, in the rush to tear down the convention center, some electrician had shut off our power rail. And because I did not turn the klaxon back on, we never found out that all the equipment had switched over to the UPS. And so that's how I brought down Interop. Mark, have you ever brought down Interop?
I've brought down sections of Interop in the past. And I'm pretty efficient at doing that.
Yes. Again, is a story you can share, or is it under NDA?
No, there's nothing under NDA here. There's just how to build a coil with your overhead ribs.
Oh, that's right.
By employing the electricians. So we're having some, we're on the show floor. And for those of you that have been to Interop, you know that we run bundles of Cat 5 structured cable overhead. And there was a show that we were doing, what had happened is the this was early on when I before I really even thought about, you know, what should be doing. One of the electricians had said, look, we've got a bunch of excess cable at the end of this. What do you want me to do? And I said, oh, just reach up there in the rafters, take it, wrap it around the steel structure. It'll be fine. Yeah. For any of you that know anything about electronics, that was not such a good idea. We had intermittent issues with that area of the show until somebody finally bothered to look up and say, you know, that doesn't quite look right. We unwheel it, we unwind it from around the steel structure, straighten it out, do it proper, no problems.
And of course, all of these stories are just part of what makes Interop Interop. Mark, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us. Now, is there something you want to let our listeners and our viewers know about? Some project that you're involved in, a place where they can find you? You got 60 seconds. Go.
Okay. So I work for the Informatic Group. One of the things that we do is technical M&A work. So in other words, you have the investment bankers that go in and handle all the financial transactions. What myself and my team do is we go in and handle the M&A for the technical standpoint. Usually when we're cutting out of networks, the corporation that's remaining keeps all of the infrastructure. The new corporation has, in most cases, almost nothing. The role for Informatic Group is to go and fill that void and provide support for the new organization, set up a new network.
Mark, thank you very much. I'll see you again because I'm going to see you every Interop. Yep. But until then, yeah, stay geeky.
We'll do it.
All right.
Take care.
Now, coming back, we're actually going to be showing you a little bit about the fabric that drives Interop. We've got a brand new system of switches from Avaya that might just change the way that we look at networking. But before we do that, I want to take time to talk about another one of our sponsors, and that's Ting. Now, you may be asking yourself, what is Ting? Well, the easiest way I could describe it is to say that Ting is a no BS cell phone service. They are an MVNO. They are a nationwide reseller of Sprint service. But what they do is they give you just what you need, nothing of what you don't. Now, how is Ting different? There are no contracts or ETFs. It's truly and completely contract free. There's no early termination fee service, no hidden charges, no bundling or ride-along. You get to choose from extra small to extra, extra large service levels for voice, text, and megabytes of data, all billed separately. Also, there are no overage charges or penalties. If you use more than you thought you would, you just pay for what you used. You also get credits on unused services. Try doing that with your current cell phone service. If you use less than you thought you would, Ting drops you down to the next level you hit and credits the difference on your next bill. When's the last time your cell phone provider gave you money back? There are also no add-on charges. Voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspot, three-way calling, call forwarding, and other features are all part of the service. There's no add-on. You also get unlimited devices on one plan. You can share your pooled minutes, messages, and megabytes. Each device on a plan only costs an extra $6 flat per month. You also get a powerful online account control panel. You can take control of your account, your usage, and bills in a powerful online control panel that, well, is just really, really simple to use. They also give you no-holds customer support. You can call them at 1-855-TING-FTW. That's 1-855-TING-FTW. Anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and a real person will pick up the phone. Also, if you don't like calling people, they have an excellent online support option at help.ting.com. They have an active forum with simple and powerful help ticketing systems, video tutorials, video startup guides, and much, much more. Now, how does Ting work? Well, it works really simply. First, you purchase your mobile device from Ting, and you'll receive it in 2 to 5 business days. Then you activate your device with Ting, and you have the option to select a new phone number or port an existing one. Finally, you select the monthly minutes, messages, and megabytes that you think represent your usage, and Ting will bill you at the beginning of your payment period, but you will be charged or credited in the following for what you actually used. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to visit Ting today at enterprise.ting.com. You can save money and better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting. Check out their savings calculator and see how much you or your company can save. Twiat viewers also save $25 off your first Ting device when you sign up. So visit enterprise.ting.com. That's enterprise.ting.com and start saving today. And we thank Ting for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now coming up, we're going to show you all about Avaya's new fabric. But before that, let me take you on another tour, a behind-the-scenes look of the InteropNet.
I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, host of TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech on the TWiET Network. I'm continuing our tour of Interop in Las Vegas at the Mandalay Bay Convention Center 2013. We're here in the NUC, where, strictly speaking, I shouldn't be driving this cart, but I'm doing it anyways because I care about you guys. What we're going to do over the next couple of minutes is I'm going to take you over some of the key features of the Interop Net. I'm going to show you how we get connectivity to our customers, to the clients, to the vendors on the floor. I'm going to show you how we get connectivity into the show itself. And then I'm going to show you the super secret pad. That's right, in the bowels of the Mandalay Bay Convention Center, where everything comes together.
Makes a difference.
So this right here, this is what we call a drop. It comes down from the ceiling from a series of catwalks that, well, the Teamsters have attached and affixed to the roof of the Mandalay Bay Convention Center. These drops come off of what we call a rib, which is a bundle of cables that we've created that go down into a patch panel. It allows us to lay several lines or ribs across the ceiling of the convention center and then have the riggers drop down one of these cables into each booth that needs internet access. Now, each of these eventually goes back to what we call a show floor pad. Now let me show you what a show floor pad looks like. I know it's hard to see at the moment, but the structure that we're coming up to with the green fiber hose and the blue bundle of cables coming out of it is what we call a PED. It has a PED protector around it, but when I go inside, you can see the equipment that's in there. It has a switch, which allows us to do gigabit and PoE out to each booth, and it also has a secondary switch at the bottom, which allows us to do our out-of-band management. Together, we have up to 16 of these show floor PEDs delivering internet connectivity to all of our customers, all of the vendors, all of our clients on the show floor. But the PED's only part of the way that we connect them. In order for the PEDs to work, we have to have the core. Now, this structure that we're coming up to, this is the InteropNet core. There's a reason why we keep it out here, because it's really loud. In fact, it's about 90 decibels right next to some of those fans. This is where we have 100 gigabit of external connectivity coming into the network, and then it gets routed throughout the entire show. That includes the classrooms, the off-show floor areas, the show floor, and, of course, us in the NOC. Now, this core in and of itself is a fascinating collection of gear. We've got switches from Avaya and Cisco. We've got F5 providing all of our protection. They're actually keeping us from being DDoSed. We also have an Ixia box in there that is actually DDoSing us with up to 100 gigabits of traffic at any given time. It's a sort of way to test the network to make sure that nothing's going to break when it gets under load. We've also got capture gear from CPacket and from NetOptics, from WildPackets. All of these vendors have come together to give us the equipment that we need to be able to set up, to maintain, to analyze the traffic that flows through our network. However, this is not the end. This is only part of the core. There's a super secret part of the core that I want to show you because it's in the bowels of the Mandalay Bay Convention Center. You know, there's only one way to drive when you're driving indoors. Going down. We're now in the bowels of the Mandalay Bay Convention Center. This is the bottom floor, and it's the place that's going to let us see exactly what we need to see, the last part of the Interop Net. Here we are in the dark underside of the convention center, and in a nondescript room in the underside of the Mandalay Bay Convention Center, we have what we like to call the super secret PED. What Mandalay Bay has allowed us to do is to bring one of our PEDs down into what we call the MDF and plug into their house fiber. As a newer convention center, they have the ability to reach out into each and every single one of these rooms with pre-run fiber. This allows us to get, well, to each and every single area with a minimum amount of fuss. Now, there is one more thing I want to show you, and that is the classrooms. You see, all of this doesn't just feed the vendors on the show floor and us in the NOC, it also goes to all the people who have paid for education. So let's take another ride.
we are in the back halls of the Mandalay Bay Convention Center. And surrounding me, pretty much on either side, are a series of classrooms. That's where the workshops and the educational sessions of Interop take place. So remember, we had all of that connectivity going into the core. We have the MDF down in the super secret pad in the basement of the Convention Center. And then that comes up into these classrooms. Without these fiber connections, without this connectivity, without the core, without the pad down in the basement, we wouldn't be able to get internet access out to all of the attendees, and therefore we wouldn't really be able to get, well, Interop running like Interop should run. Let's go back to the knock. I want to thank you for joining us on the Interop Net Tour. We've taken you everywhere from the show floor to the core, down to the basement, to the classrooms, and back here to the NOC. This is not just an educational opportunity, it really is a community of geeks and nerds, the guys behind me who make the Interop Net work. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire. Stay tuned, because we've got more from Interop Las Vegas 2013.
Now, the funny thing about that, and Chibra, I'm going to throw over to you for a second, is, you know, it seems big, yet you do need a cart to go up and down and move everything everywhere. But this is actually a really small convention center compared to where we used to live at the Las Vegas Convention Center, right?
Actually, this is a hotel convention center. This is pretty typical. I think it's about 750,000 square feet. But when you start getting into, say, like Orlando or the full-size Las Vegas Convention Center or Miami, we're talking about multiple millions of square feet. And if you really want to talk big, let's go talk about the Hanover Fair, Hanover Messe in Frankfurt, Germany. That sucker is something along the lines of 10 million square feet. Right.
I remember in the days of Interop at the LVCC, it used to be that you might work on one section of the network without ever seeing another section just because it was so big. It spans so many buildings. Here, even though it is big, it's so much easier to manage than it used to be.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot easier, especially like the Atlanta, the Georgia World Congress Center. We had teams that would do the South Hall and another team would do the North Hall. And we'd only see each other at dinner, perhaps.
Now, we're also talking about management here. We're talking about a different way of managing the network. And that's why we've got a super special guest, Mr. Steve Emmert from Avaya. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks, Padre.
Now, Steve, Avaya is in the core of Interop. You are the ones who are driving every single packet of information that flows either in or out. Tell me, what is Avaya doing at Interop? Why are you here?
Okay. Padre, what we're doing here is we're trying to provide the core. We're doing a new technology called shortest path bridging, so we're trying to showcase that technology. We're not only using it in the core of the Interop network, but also we're showing some interoperability with a couple of other vendors out there. Huawei is a private one that we've done in the past. HP and Alcatel-Lucent and Spirent, packet testers.
Now, the shortest path bridging, I've heard it before. This would be opposed to what we've traditionally used, which is spanning tree, right? So in the old way of networking, we would hop from switch to switch to switch to switch until we get to destination. How is that different in shortest path?
Well, we're really not changing the basic rules of networking. We're adding to them.
Ah.
So what we're doing is we're creating a network fabric. You've heard a lot of terms of network fabrics, most associated with the data center recently. Well, we're taking the network fabric and extending it throughout the enterprise. What that really means is we're giving a way to create a, I hate to overuse that word, the network fabric, but we're creating a backbone that spans from wiring closet to the core to the distribution, you know, everything in between. And it gives us this ability to set it, create kind of a set it and forget it type of network.
Hmm.
We create the core services, they're there, they stay there, and we only have to provision things at the edge as things are changed.
Oh, I get it. So in other words, once you've got enough of these switches with Avaya Fabric, or we'll just call it shortest path bridging, with shortest path bridging enabled, you actually have like a cloud of switches. And rather than having to hop between individual switches within that cloud, you have just the border. You go in and you come out.
Well, you still, of course, adhere to a lot of the traditional rules of networking. So we do
That's
hop from switch to switch. But,
for
example, if a user hanging off a VLAN on one edge switch were to try to ping or to try to trace route to a device hanging, you know, 20 switches away and on different subnet. Normally, if you do a trace route, you'd see hop to hop to hop to hop from IP interface to IP interface. What you see with shortest path bridging is one hop to the local interface, and then it goes through the cloud. It's actually switched at layer two through the cloud, and then emerges on the other side. So from a layer three standpoint, it looks like one big, gigantic extended router, if you will.
Right. And that's actually one of the important points here, which is you wouldn't have to replace your entire infrastructure because Avaya Fabric still speaks the language of traditional switches. You could hook up a traditional switch, traditional router, to the edge of the Avaya Fabric, and it would look at the Avaya Fabric as just one big traditional switch.
Yeah, very true. And okay. Actually, that's exactly what we're doing on the show floor here at Interop, because everybody has their own switches, their own routers, their own devices out on the show floor in their exhibits. So we're providing a connection that's a conventional connection. So it looks just like a normal internet connection, but it's going through this shortest path bridging fabric from the pedestals that are providing the show floor connectivity back to the distribution, back to the core.
Right.
And then at that point, we hand off to actually F5, where they're doing a lot of the routing because they're doing load balancing of services. So we're creating this extended switch in, you know, kind of a cloud-based extended switch, if you will, in this case.
Right.
Chibert, I want to throw this over to you. As I believe it was Eric Duckman mentioned, to do the hoppity hop, you know, the traditional way of running a network is to hop from switch to switch, router to router. It sounds like the fabric idea is so much easier. Why is it that it's taken so long to move to an idea like that? And do you think there would ever be a reason to move back?
No, let's not go back. I like this. Being able to do this type of thing at layer two and layer three, like TVS Egon was saying, it is very MPLS-ish. But we're doing this at layer two and also layer three, and it just makes a lot of sense. It's really cool. It's almost as if we had a local cloud. Ooh, what a concept.
All right, man. Actually, let me throw over to you, Curtis. This is one of these things that it's getting more and more traction. Different vendors call it different things, but it is shortest path bridging. The idea of turning all of the switches in your enterprise into one big switch. Now, there are obvious advantages from the perspective of the IT administrator. It's easier to set up. It's easier to configure. It's easier to point where you need it to point. But is there awareness, again, at that executive level, at the enterprise executive level, of what shortest path bridging can do for the efficiency of an IT department?
I think when you ask about any specific technology, the answer is going to be pretty much no. Yeah. But when you look at the concepts that the IT department are bringing to the executive suite, the idea that you can make the network more agile, that you can make the network be able to respond to changing business conditions the same way that elastic computing, that cloud-based computing has responded to rapidly changing business needs, that's something that resonates with the executive suite. And what we're really getting into is the notion that the entire IT infrastructure, from networking to storage to compute power, is responsive to the changing business needs at the speed that business needs them to change. That's something that we're seeing some really great resonance up in the executive suite with.
Right. Can I amplify on that a little bit?
Absolutely.
Because really, you said some of the very important things that are there for shortest path bridging, because when you try to, you know, everybody in the technology world is loving looking at the new technologies, but you know, you have to deal with a business standpoint. So what are the things that from a business standpoint we need to do? We need to bring up new services very quickly. The network is now a utility. It has to be there. It has to be there and it has to be very agile all the time. So we have to bring up the new services quickly. It has to be very reliable and be able to converge very quickly. In case of some failure, it has to be able to route around that failure. We have to be able to simplify it. You know, nobody's budgets are increasing. Everybody's budget is shrinking. We're trying to do more with less people. So we have to have a technology that gives us the ability to do more with less. And that's exactly what shortest path bridging does, because, again, we create this set it and forget it backbone, and we provision changes at the edge. One example I've seen recently is one of our customers that's gone to this technology. They had to do a major change to add some services for vMotion from one data center to another, so they could extend a VLAN across so that they could have virtual servers move from their primary data center to their secondary data center. In the past, that's been a month-long change cycle they had to go through because they had to change their core network. This last change, because they've implemented this new technology, it's a minor change. They didn't have to go through the core changes. And they went from a month-long cycle of change control down to a few minutes, literally, because all they had to do was turn on the new service on the edges and they were done. So all of those things come together, make it much simpler and much easier to manage a network. It's almost as if, you know, and we are adding in the additional knowledge within the network, the autonomy in the network. One of our product managers actually is talking about autonomous networking, that it really reacts automatically to changes in the network so that we can provide those services without a lot of human intervention.
Okay. Steve, let me ask you this. Okay, so there's going to be people in the chat room. I already see them start to gather. Who are going to say, I'm hearing too much marketing speak. I'm hearing too many buzzwords here. They get the provisioning thing. They get it's, that it's easier to just provision at the edge. But can you describe to me how this would actually change a deployment? Let's use something like Interop. Give me a traditional deployment, and don't name any vendors, but give me what it would be traditionally using, you know, MPLS, using a spanning tree, et cetera, versus using shortest path bridging.
Okay. Well, I haven't been involved personally with Interop before as a background vendor, but, you know, from a normal network implementation, from my experience, has been I'll have VLANs out at the edge where users connect in. We may or may not route at that very edge, the wiring closet. We'll probably... you know, in a lot of situations I see, we extend those VLANs with 802.1Q VLAN tagging back to the core, and we do routing in the core. So now we've dealt with two protocols. We've dealt with spanning tree at the edge. We've dealt with either spanning tree or some modification of spanning tree that provides additional resiliency between the edge and the core. And then we're dealing with OSPF and or RIP or whatever protocols we're using. So we're using a mix of a number of protocols. With shortest path bridging, I get rid of that mix of protocols. One thing we haven't talked about yet at the core of this thing is a routing protocol. So basically, we're routing it at layer two, and it's called ISIS. They've been using ISIS in carrier world for, 20 years or more. And it turns out that's a very extensible protocol. It's a link state protocol. It provides all of the characteristics for a layer two network that we get with a OSPF network today. So we have that same characteristics of and advantages of routing that we have from, you know, from a routed network like OSPF, but all-encompassing layer two and layer three.
Right, right. Chibert, I want to bring you in on this because you have a lot of experience with Interop, and you have experience with the nightmare that is our VLAN soup. The fact that we have to get different connections to different parts of the network at all given times. Most of the time, we're moving across different vendors' gear, and it tends to be a nightmare, especially when something breaks and then we kind of have to untangle the cables and figure out what's plugged into what. My understanding is that shortest path bridging would actually help us with that, because if we do see all of the switches in a network as one big switch, and if we only have to provision at the edge, we get to take away a lot of that guesswork and a lot of that kludge work, right?
Oh, yeah. Over the years, we've seen a lot of changes in the technologies that provide it. It's always been that big question. Do we route at the edge or do we route at the core? Well, when we start talking about short path bridging, we don't really have to make that decision anymore. We can move things around very easily. So if we have, say, for instance, a need for a special wireless VLAN someplace, it's not a redesign. It's a reconfig. So it's pretty cool, and I'm really looking forward to learning more about it. In fact, I'm going to try and twist Steve's arm and get permission to take the recording that we did, a class that we did at Hot State, and see if we can share that with the chat room.
Okay. All right. Steve, all right, I got to go back to you on this one. One of the questions that executives are going to want to know, and I'm going to throw this to Curtis in a little bit, is, well, okay, you say it's more efficient. You say it's leveraging synergies. And great, I understand those buzzwords, but exactly how much money am I going to save? You know, in the long run, let's talk long run here, because of course a deployment, it's going to require an outlay. But in the long run, where do you see the efficiencies coming in? What changes? What becomes easier? What becomes less expensive to do?
Well, hardware is going to be hardware. So we're not going to make a huge amount of change in that. There is a, when you have to take a look at what shortest path bridging does, you mentioned earlier that there were MPLS-like services. And MPLS does provide us that capability to virtualize a lot of different services, provide security segregation from different services, provide different segregation of services for different types of operations in a hospital, separating the patient monitoring from the normal, just administrative functions, things like that. You don't want to hit things like the patient monitoring or radiology and things like that. You want that to be absolutely 100% reliable. So those are the kind of soft cost savings. So we can, it's really reducing human errors. It's really reducing human efforts to configure and manage and monitor. It's being able to adapt to the network, to the business's changes as they need to bring things together. So, you know, I don't have real hard cost savings because, you know, the networking hardware, you know, we've gone from, you know, gigabit to 10 gigabit, 40 gig, 100 gig, all of that stuff still continues, but we're making it utilize the pathways more efficiently because, like its name says, shortest path bridging uses the shortest, most efficient path for any given transaction from its source to destination. So from that standpoint, we're simply using the equipment more effectively. Yeah. But really, the cost savings are mostly human cost savings, faster time to service, being all of those good business-level buzzwords.
Curtis, let me throw this to you. Hearing that and knowing that, you know, it's at the very beginning, it's going to be sort of a net scrub. You might get more efficiencies, but you do have to redeploy your network, assuming that it's not a brand spanking new network. Do you think the executive side of the enterprise will understand that? And if they do, what do you think will be the first institutions that would go with a network that can be reconfigured on the fly, reconfigured more quickly, that can be provisioned in a matter of keystrokes rather than in a number of days?
I think where you're going to start seeing companies go with this are companies that are depending on changing their infrastructure to take greater advantage of things like cloud and offsite provisioning of different compute functions. For example, when I talk to healthcare providers, especially those that are bringing multiple installations into a large network, they're looking at going from a self-hosted to a cloud-based provisioning model to be able to change their network access models to deal with that in the same way that they're changing their compute access so that they don't have to re-architect their network every time they bring a new facility online, every time they bring a new service provider online. When you're looking at, for example, retail, installations that are growing by acquisition and don't want to have to re-architect a network every time they bring a new company in. You know, those are the sort of things where the executives are saying to the IT department, we must have an agile infrastructure. You must be able to respond to our business needs. We don't care about the technology. We care about the results. You know, Steve mentioned the commoditization of networking. That's something that we're seeing of all the IT infrastructure. It's not just network, it's not just security, it's not just storage, it's everything going to an on-demand, rapidly provisioned model. This fits right into that when you can tell the network story with the same language that you're using to tell all the other stories about IT resources. That's something where you're going to get minimal pushback and maximum awareness from the executive suite.
Chibert, I want to give you one of the last words here to talk about shortest path bridging. Where do you expect to see this technology headed in the next, say, 2-3 years? Are we going to see every vendor with some form of this by next interop?
I'm already starting to see a lot of the big players with a form of this, or at least the basic idea. I personally think it is a way to go. It is the way to go, especially as we start seeing things like OpenStack, OpenFlow, open this, open that. Being able to have, say, for instance, a single point of management has been a dream of a lot of IT people for a long time. So I think this is a great direction to go in, and I strongly encourage everybody to check it out.
Steve, I want to give you the last word on this. Okay, so We now know what shortest path bridging is. We see where the efficiencies are. We see why it would make our jobs as engineers easier if we can provision on the outside. But where do you see Avaya taking this? I mean, obviously, Avaya has bought in wholeheartedly. This is the future of Avaya networking. But Where do you think the big milestones are? What do you want to see in a year, in 2 years, in 3 years, in terms of adoption, in terms of interoperability, in terms of people understanding what this could bring to their network?
I certainly want to see, and I expect to see it become pervasive. You know, again, one of the nice things about shortest path bridging is it's both an IEEE and an IETF standard. So it is a standard, and that means interoperability. So that means that we are able to definitely interoperate with other vendors. It's really going to be the way that we do build networks. So, where do I expect to see it go? Working for a unified communication company, you know, we really want to see that tied together. You know, the ability to adapt quickly and easily with video conferencing, live video as we're doing right now. Audio conferencing, audio, you know, tying together all forms of communication, whether it's audio, video, textual, you know, chat, everything, tying that together and being able to deal with that in one spot. One example is actually multicasting. One thing that we've seen is a strong requirement for networks is security for video. And you take a look at how many cameras are, especially in a venue like this, the Mandalay Bay, a casino, there are cameras all over the place, and there are thousands of cameras. How do you deal with the multicasting all of those cameras? And that's one thing we're able to do with this technology very easily is deal with those multicasts and make it more effective. Bottom line is it adapts to anything that the businesses want or need to do. And it really is changing the game in how networks are being put together.
Well, you know what? That's it. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise tech show on the planet. And that's absolutely according to a poll that I just made up. I do want to thank my panelists, starting with Brian Chi, the evangelist of ThinLinks. Brian, thanks again for being, you know, Twite's not the same without you and Curtis. So tell us, what do the Twite right need to know about you, about what you're doing, about the projects that you've got running?
Well, I'd like you to come and visit me in Los Angeles when I'm exhibiting at Citrix Synergy. We're going to be showing off our new line of thin clients. And some people have been very curious about that teeny tiny little server I've been using on the Intel Next Unit of Computing that I managed to shoehorn Server 2008 on. Well, I also shoehorned Citrix onto it. So come on down and visit us at the booth.
Yeah, fantastic. Curtis, over at Enterprise Efficiency, you've always got good stuff going on. You've got great content coming out. In fact, I think you just came here after creating something for Enterprise Efficiency. What do you want the Twite Riot to know about your work?
Well, we're going to be covering interop all week long over at Enterprise Efficiency. I'm going to be live blogging a number of conference sessions, the keynote sessions. I'm going to be talking to a lot of people here at interop. So you'll see a number of interviews as well as videos, audios, doing the full multimedia extravaganza. Once interop's over, I go back to Florida. I'm home for almost 36 hours before I head back out to SAP's Sapphire Now, where I'll be doing the same sort of thing next week, but covering big enterprise ERP. If you're at either one of those shows, come by, say hello. If you're not, please follow my coverage, comment, ask questions at enterpriseefficiency.com.
Fantastic. Over to you, Steve. Thanks again, because, you know, this is one of those topics that maybe some people don't understand, but it's going to become more and more pressing that they know it. You're going to have to know shortest path bridging. And you know what? Avaya's got a damn good implementation. So can you tell us, in a couple of words, in 60 seconds, what people should know, where they should go, where do they want to find out more information about shortest path bridging?
Actually, a couple of good places. Obviously, my company's website, avaya.com, networking, I believe. But also, do a Google search on shortest path bridging, edu2.1aq. You're going to find all of the technoid stuff, of course, but a number of white papers that you'll see the business capabilities of it, some of the technology capabilities of it. There's actually a lot of very good information out there just with a simple Google search looking at it. And again, it's not just Avaya's technology. We may have pioneered it, and we're developing it quite quickly, but again, it's becoming an interoperable standard, so there are a number of vendors out there, including all of the big ones.
Thanks again. And of course, thanks to you. That's right, because without you who are listening, who are watching this program, we wouldn't be able to do a show. We wouldn't be able to have the accolades of millions and millions of people around the world, again, according to a poll that I just made up. But You could have each and every single episode of Twilight Goodness downloaded into your device of choice every single week automatically. That's right. What you need to do is drop by our show page at twit.tv/Twilight. There you'll be able to find all the different ways that you can get Twilight dropped into your device with no user input. That's right. You want it on your iPad? Sure. iPod? Duh. iPhone? No brainer. Android or tablet or phone? Of course. Even if you wanted it into a zombie Zune, we've got your back because we love you. Also, you could download this. In fact, I'm hoping that you're downloading it because you can listen to it in the car or you could watch a high-resolution version at home. But just for giggles, why not stop by and watch us do it live? That's right. Every Monday at noon Pacific time, you can watch us put the sausage together live. You get to see all the stuff that doesn't go into the download. You get to see us set up. You get to see us joke around afterwards. You get to see the heart of Twilight. I just made that up, but again, that's all good. Also, if you are going to check us out live, why not drop by the chat room? Our chat room is filled with some of the greatest engineers, some of the brightest minds, some of the absolute funniest trolls, and yes, the mods. We love our mods. Stop on by and experience Twit's experiment with temporary community. Did you know that we also have a YouTube page? And there's a reason for you to drop by the YouTube page now. If you go to youtube.com/Twilight, not only will you be able to see all of our videos, but as you can see at the top of that list, we're starting to upload all of the individual segments. Stuff My IT Guy Says, The Data Closet, Pro Gear, Pro Tip, all of those different segments that have made Twilight so much fun over the last year, you're going to be able to watch them on your own. In sequence, you could sit down and have a Stuff My IT Guy Says party with your executive. And you know what? That's what people have been asking for. Also, you can thank CyberDog, who currently is in the chat room. In fact, CyberDog, who's currently here. CyberDog, come on around. This is the man who helps to put everything into show notes, which means after the show, we need someone who can transcribe our notes, make it intelligible, and put it up on the website. He's actually one of our interop ITMs. That's right. He watched Twilight, and because he watched Twilight, he decided to join us, and now he's flexing, which is actually kind of strange. Finally, thanks to everyone back at the Brick House who makes this show possible. Karsten, my super producer. Jason, my absolutely lovable TD, who I hope has a camera aimed at him right now because he knows I'm going to ask him this question. Jason, might there be a show on the Twit Network that talks about Android and maybe what Android could do for those who are in the enterprise?
Yeah, it's called iPad Today, and it's, no, it's called All About Android, actually. Man, I've been away 2 weeks, and look what happens.
I know. And wait, why were you away for 2 weeks again? I'm sorry, you were on vacation, right?
It's a little matter of having a baby. Yeah, had a baby, so I don't know if that's necessarily vacation. It's kind of a staycation, actually.
Yeah, so it's staycation. Yeah, it's not any kind of cation at all. So no. Twilight Riot, welcome Jason back. You know we love him. You know, everyone else at the Brick House is great, but we've got a special place in our heart for the Jason. Oh. Finally, I want to thank everyone here at Interop for giving us a space, for letting us set up. This has been a fantastic opportunity. And you, remember, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.